Well, there's some interesting things about this program, and I'll point a few of them out, and then we can go from there. The first one is that the first half of the program consists of early works by Strauss and Schoenberg, and the second half of the program has a late work by Brahms. The Strauss and the Schoenberg occur first in the program. The Brahms comes last in the program. I'm stepping around the issue of Brahms being really the influence of Strauss and Schoenberg, and I'll also mention that Schoenberg wrote an essay called "Brahms the Progressive." This is a time when Brahms was thought of as a classicist, as an old school kind of guy. So tell us how you came about creating this program, including Strauss, Schoenberg, and Brahms.
And the title of our program this evening, as you know, is Progressives, and that really is where the title comes from, is that Schoenberg essay, when he helped folks begin to rethink Brahms, rethink him as a progressive type composer, instead of what many people looked at as a sort of the end of the traditional line of Western European composers, or at least near the end of that line. And Daniel's absolutely correct about the music on this program. It's these pieces are very tightly connected to one another in a variety of different ways, and they do revolve very much around the figure of Johannes Brahms, and especially his Fourth Symphony, which is his last symphony. It's a work with which he struggled greatly and yet also achieved really incredible success, both aesthetically but also in terms of the response of the audience. His Third and Fourth Symphonies were both very well received. And it was right around this time that Strauss was a young composer and conductor as well, very much under the influence of Brahms, even crossing paths sort of with Brahms in an unusual way around this time. And then, of course, Daniel mentioned Schoenberg writes this essay called Brahms the Progressive. And Schoenberg himself was very much involved with thinking about Brahms, what he had done in his music, and where that left him as a musical artist. Sometimes we hear Schoenberg and think about him, and even this piece that we're going to hear tonight for Klärte Nacht, and we think about Wagner or Mahler. But I think there's a lot to talk about when we discuss the connection between these two composers, Brahms and Schoenberg, as well when we talk about for Klärte Nacht. So the selection of works is guided a bit by that idea. There's also a city that lurks behind this, even two cities, really, or two places. And the central place that sort of is in the shadows or in the background behind this program is the city of Vienna in the last 20 years of the 19th century. I was very fortunate to spend a number of months in Vienna myself studying this period. It ultimately led me to write a piece about Gustav Mahler's conducting activities, because during this time, not quite when Brahms wrote his Fourth Symphony, just a little bit after that, a few years after that, Mahler came to Vienna, and he became really one of the city's most famous and most well-known, most influential performers. And of course, he was also a composer as well. Brahms lived in Vienna at the end of his life. In fact, when Mahler arrived and took over as the conductor of the Vienna State Opera, was the exact same year in which Brahms died. And right when Mahler had arrived in Vienna, there was a big funeral procession on the streets for Brahms. These things were a big part of folks' life in Vienna at this time. Classical music was the central art form of the city of this time. It was something that a lot of these composers commented on. Schoenberg certainly comments on it, that the audience is very well-schooled in a certain kind of music. And Schoenberg, I think, ultimately felt that that went against him, because as he made his advancements in music, he felt that the audience wasn't able to accept what he was saying. But Brahms was very popular in Vienna, and Strauss actually spent some time in Vienna, although we'll find out that Strauss and Brahms are tied together through a different situation, which is the orchestra of Meiningen. But maybe we'll get to that in a separate question. Mm-hmm. So we have this connection between the composers in this program, and also we have the city of Vienna, which is sort of in the background of the music that we're going to hear.
I think you made a good point, and I want to focus on that, in that we, when we say the word Brahms or the name Brahms, we often think of, well, I like that. That's romantic music. That's beautiful melodies. And then you say the word Schoenberg, and almost the complete opposite happens. Oh, I can't stand modern music. I don't like Schoenberg. But what I hear you saying and what happens is that really all of this was happening around the same time, and that maybe our own preferences in music can somehow stretch the timeline here and push Brahms further away from Schoenberg than he really was.
And I think that Brahms as a composer is an interesting case in that perhaps more than any other composer, perhaps in the whole canon, Brahms is able to really be in dialogue with the rest of music history, and particularly the music of Bach and of Beethoven, but also other composers as well. There really isn't another composer out there whose music seems so grounded in the music of the past, and yet when we talk a little bit more specifically about the Fourth Symphony, there are things about it which are quite modern. Of course, Schoenberg is known for basically destroying tonality, at least that's the rap he's been given. he kind of developed, or invented is not quite the right word, but developed a system for composition which we know as a 12-tone system, sort of the basis for kind of music called serialism. And this is music in which the traditional relationship between notes on a major scale is not the basis for the harmony and the melody of the piece. Instead, it's a 12-note row pulled from the 12 notes of the chromatic scale. And so when Schoenberg got further into this, and this is a bit later on than the piece you're going to hear tonight, for Verklärte Nacht is actually one of Schoenberg's earlier works. Once Schoenberg got into his newer style of composition, I think that's really where he gained a reputation for being difficult to listen to, being really quite avant-garde. But with this piece, he wasn't quite there yet. The interesting tidbit about Verklärte Nacht is that it was not well received either at the time. And later on, Schoenberg writes an essay going, you know, if you look at my Verklärte Nacht, I mean, everybody really should have loved it, but they booed anyway. So it's not my 12-tone system that causes the problem. It's something else. And that's the premise of that essay, which he wrote. But I think there are things in Verklärte Nacht that certainly would have unsettled the Viennese audience. And at the same time, we hear Schoenberg as a young man trying to work out the influences of these other composers in his life. And those composers included Brahms and Strauss, as well as Mahler and Wagner. And Schoenberg, of course, is somebody also with his own personal voice. We hear that already in this piece.
One more historical context question, then we'll get on to the pieces on the program. Brahms was a mentor and someone who encouraged composers like Dohnányi and Zemlinsky. And so let's go from there and maybe forward and tell us just sort of how all of these composers are related in terms of what I like to call as their musical lineage.
Well, Brahms, of course, is actually more of a German composer than an Austrian composer. It may seem odd for me to actually make that distinction, but there are sort of two poles within German-speaking music over the centuries, essentially. And the German tradition emanates more from the northern Germans and the organ music of some of the Baroque masters, as well as, of course, Bach. And then the Austrian tradition is more centered on the city of Vienna and springs more from, of course, Haydn and Mozart and Salieri and their contemporaries in Vienna through Schubert in the earlier part of the 19th century and Beethoven, although Beethoven, again, is a bit on the line. And then, of course, down through Strauss, the Strauss family of waltz, you name it, fame. So there's, even within this tradition of sort of German-speaking classical music, there are sort of two subtle streams here. And Brahms is in a way, kind of at the mouth of this I don't know what you'd call it, but this diversion of mm-hmm. traditions or maybe gathering of traditions. Maybe even a third tradition you could put in there for Brahms, as well as the strong interest in folk influence music. And Brahms actually was rich and famous in large measure due to these Hungarian dances, which you might have heard before. They were hugely popular for piano, and then of course in their orchestral form as well. And Brahms even encouraged Dvorak to write these kinds of pieces, knowing that Dvorak brought a particular kind of folk-ish flair to his music because of where he was from. So Brahms is here able to really be at the center of these different streams, and we hear that in his music. A couple of concrete examples for you, just from this symphony. In the last movement, which is considered to be really, I think, the centerpiece of this whole symphony, he's actually building the whole movement on a small musical cell, a little bass line, which he takes from a Bach cantata. He slightly modifies it, And then he builds this incredible movement. An unprecedented movement is built on something so strongly rooted in the past. It's very, very typical of Brahms to do that. Within the space of that movement, what's fabulous is that with the limits he set for himself, this bass line, the harmony is the same every 8 bars for the whole piece. The amount of variety and the way he uses the orchestra and the imagination in there, I think it shows his ability to at once be so strongly connected to tradition on one hand and yet opening up new horizons on the other hand. And I think audiences generally have sensed that about Brahms, but for some reason, for a time, he was considered more of a conservative. I tend to see him as being someone who was really very much at this interesting confluence of these different streams. And with Brahms, we really do see, in a way, some of those streams of thought in musical composition come to an end in his music. I think there is something to be said for some of the critics who say about the last movement of the Fourth Symphony that it's the end of that tradition that started with Bach, in a way. I think Schoenberg would argue with that, and I think others might argue with that as well. But you can sense that Brahms may have felt that way a little bit when he was writing the piece. Of course, it's E minor. There is quite a bit of dramatic music in it, but it's not an overbearingly minor symphony either, so I don't want to ascribe that to it.
Well, and one of my favorite parts in all of Brahms' music is the second movement of the Fourth Symphony. And it's just this gorgeous slow movement with this beautiful horn and bassoon writing, and so I'll let you talk a little bit more about that movement. I, from what I know, that's based on an Alphorn song that Brahms heard.
Yeah, it's if you listen to the beginning of the second movement, and you close your eyes, forget you're here in the Brown Theater, and imagine yourself somewhere in the Austrian woods or in the Salzburg countryside, you could sort of imagine perhaps this sound coming from across the valley. Even the way that he writes the beginning of the second movement has this feeling, a little bit of the sound gathering and echoing in a large space and then dissipating as the music stops. That's how the movement opens. It's kind of solemn, probably a little bit more solemn than your typical Alphorn piece, but it's really the very regular rhythm, bum, bum, ba, da, dum, bum, dee, da, da, and he repeats it several times. You have this effect of being in this wonderful large space. It's actually an effect that Mahler uses frequently, where as you hear in his music, you feel like you're in a vast outdoor space, a huge valley or something. Not as frequent in Brahms, but I think Daniel makes a great analogy, and I do sense that at the beginning of the movement. What's astonishing is the way that melts away after just the first 10 seconds into, I just think, just a heartbreaking chorale. And it's interesting to note that in the Third Symphony, Brahms had also written a wind chorale in the slow movement, and he does it again in the Fourth Symphony. Both of those chorales also are marked by a sudden change when the winds finish the chorale. There's just a sort of a beautiful, luminous moment as the strings come in. It's almost as if we leave that world that we're in and we return to this world of just pure orchestral beauty. That's what you get with the second theme in the second movement when the strings come in. And then eventually the movement moves into more of a bit of, I guess, a struggle sort of in a way between the winds and the strings. You'll hear it very clearly in many spots in the symphony, but particularly in the second movement. I'm a clarinet player by training prior to my conducting work, and so this is one of my favorite movements as well. Both the Third Symphony second movement and the Fourth Symphony second movement feature the clarinet. Fortunately for me tonight, it will be Andrea performing this beautiful solo and not myself, but maybe fortunate for you as well. But it's one of those movements, if you're a clarinetist or a wind player, you love to play it. And I think the winds are really enjoying doing this. It gives them an opportunity to play together almost as if they're playing chamber music, wind serenades. And it's really just fabulous to feel that group, that music within the music. And then, of course, it enlarges, as I said, when the strings come in.
The winds are, I guess, particularly happy tonight and maybe have been in a good mood all week because they get to start the program with a serenade by Strauss. Really early work of Strauss. It reminds me a lot of Mozart. It's almost like one of his wind serenades. Let's talk about that, the Strauss, the serenade.
Yeah, now if you're looking to situate these pieces with one another in the space of time, and I'll probably mention this from the stage when I have a few comments, because I always like to touch on these kinds of things, give you a different frame for thinking about these works. Some of you may remember a band called Nirvana, and they put out a great album called Nevermind, which was a huge, massive hit. That was just about 20 years ago. That's the amount of space between the Strauss and the Schoenberg, and the Brahms is in the middle. So we think of that as a very short period of time in our own musical history. So we're talking in terms of timeline, a very, very short period of time, especially when we normally discuss music like this. 50 years is actually considered, you know, kind of a short time, relatively speaking. So 20 years from the Strauss to the Schoenberg, and then the Brahms is in the middle. Now, the Strauss is the earliest of the three works. It was written by its composer when he was 17 in the early 1880s. And Strauss was another one of these very talented, very precocious musicians. He was gifted. His gift was clear at an early age. And he, at this time in his life, he really worshipped the music of Brahms, partly because Strauss had the opportunity to work with a conductor named Hans von Bülow with a court orchestra in Meiningen. And von Bülow was a really kind of a well-known conductor and figure during the second half of the 19th century. He was very involved with Wagner, both in good and bad ways over time. He was the conductor who was behind the initial performances of several Brahms symphonies. His orchestra was considered to be one of the great orchestras in Europe during the 19th century. And Strauss apprenticed with him. And also, eventually, in a weird twist of events that has to do with the Fourth Symphony, eventually Strauss came to conduct von Bülow's orchestra when he stepped back from that position. In any case, Strauss was very familiar with the music of Brahms, even when he wrote this piece just a few years before Brahms wrote the Fourth Symphony. And I think in addition to the Mozart voice that you hear in Strauss, which comes again and again in Strauss's life, in pieces like Rosenkavalier and in some of his chamber operas, we hear the spirit of Mozart in Strauss. We have it here in this piece as well. Of course, Mozart wrote a lot of music for wind band, and that was very popular as party music during Mozart's lifetime, and that was one of the reasons why Mozart wrote that music. He actually wrote a lot of party music. That was one of his responsibilities in Vienna. Wind music on its own sort of founded a little bit in the first half of the 19th century, although composers like Beethoven and Mendelssohn did write for the group. And then Strauss, early in his career, writes a couple of really wonderful pieces. The serenade is actually called a symphony, but I think that refers more to like sort of the symphonia concept going back to the Baroque era, a single movement which would encapsulate a number of different ideas. So we have Strauss at this very young age writing for 13 instruments, is that right? Mm-hmm. Yes, it is, yeah. 13 instruments, four horns, and then double in the rest of the winds, plus a contrabassoon or tuba. And what he really wanted was that extra low octave to be able to use that. So he included either the contrabassoon or the tuba. Tonight we'll be performing the piece with Roger on contrabassoon because you don't find many contrabassoon players like Roger. It's great to have bass like that. you'll feel it right in the middle of your body when we get to some of the big spots. What's interesting about the piece is it sounds, as Daniel alluded to, it sounds more like other composers than Strauss. There are a few moments that remind us of the more mature Strauss, or I guess that I should say the sort of premonition, the later Strauss. One of those I want you to listen for is at the end of the piece. It's a very pleasant work, and at the end of the piece there's kind of a big climax, and the music begins to calm down, and then there are these series of very haunting, unusual chords just in the last minute of the piece. And at those moments, as the harmonies move around and you have just a single melodic line that sort of wends its way through these chords, you'll hear some of the experiments in harmony that we know Strauss would begin to do later in his career. And as we're tuning some of these chords, just a bit of an insight into rehearsal, we get so accustomed sometimes when we're playing Brahms that the chords are going to be spelled in a particular way, meaning the composer has set the notes for different instruments in such a way that it fits, it feels great, and it's actually quite easy to tune. Then we reach this moment in the Strauss, and all of a sudden it becomes difficult to tune. Why can't we figure this out? And there are half steps in the chord. There are notes that are just separated by half a step, which is obviously not something you have as often in a composer like Brahms. And that's where you really begin to feel the later Strauss, the Strauss who would experiment with bitonality, writing in two keys at once. We hear that when we get to the end of it. I also hear John, our principal horn player upstairs, playing a bit of the Strauss, a beautiful moment. So you'll catch some before the show. It's a little bonus of coming to the pre-concert.
Right. In a few moments, we'll let you ask some questions. Take us maybe just a quick walk through the Schoenberg, Verklärte Nacht, Transfigured Night.
Yes, Verklärte Nacht means Transfigured Night. And this is a work for strings, which is based on a poem by an Austrian poet named Richard Demel. Now, the work is not just a work for strings. It was originally written for string sextet. And it's been interesting to talk to the string players about what it feels like to play this work in the sextet version. I think it's glorious and exciting, and there's a lot that you can do. And apparently also one of the common emotions playing this work in the sextet version is extreme fear. It's so exposed and so difficult that it's kind of this monument for string chamber musicians to play. Shortly after it was introduced, Schoenberg made an arrangement for string orchestra, and eventually he revised that arrangement. So the orchestra is split in a slightly different way, and you can even see this as you look on stage, and especially as the orchestra's playing. There are 7 parts as opposed to the normal 5. Usually we have the violins split in 2, the first and second violins, and then the violas and the cellos and the basses. In this piece, we have first and second violins, first and second violas, first and second cellos, and then the basses. Of course, the basses are taking part of the second cello part from the sextet because there was no bass part in the original. So it's not really, I was talking with Bert Witzel, our principal bass player, about this, not really the most virtuosic bass part, but you'll be amazed to hear what Schoenberg does when he includes the bass or when he does not include the bass. It really has a huge effect on the feeling and sound of the ensemble. Now, the poem itself is in 5 sections, and it's this very kind of decadent sort of post-romantic poem about a woman and a man walking in the moonlight. And you'll probably be able to read more about this in the program, but essentially she makes this very painful and powerful admission to the man, and he absolves her of her grief and her struggle over this issue, and his act sort of transfigures this night for the two of them. This kind of poem and even the interest of musicians and artists in this kind of a story is very typical of Vienna in the last years of the 19th century and the first years of the 20th century. This sort of eerie moonlit scenes with sort of unspeakable things and yet also great longings and passions, is sort of throbbing post-romantic type aesthetic images were quite common, and you even see these images in the works of painters like Gustav Klimt and Egon Schiele and Kokoschka, the Austrian artists who were working in Vienna around the same time. And of course, we hear it in the music not only of Schoenberg, but even of Mahler. If you think of Mahler's vocal works for voice and orchestra, he's drawing on a lot of poetry from the same tradition. So it's not unusual that a young Schoenberg would have been drawn to this. He does, at certain points in the piece, begin to experiment more thoroughly with a strongly, strongly chromatic style. So the beginning of the piece, you'll think, Schoenberg? This is not the Schoenberg I thought I knew. If you don't know this work, you're in for a wonderful surprise. Yeah. But as the work goes on, with each buildup of each of these 5 sections, it seems to become more and more tortured and more conflicted until the last big buildup, when we have, in a way, kind of almost a complete chromatic section. He moves through almost a whole scale's worth of chromatic chords, and it gets kind of sort of ugly in a way for a few moments before the final resolution, which is this beautiful, incredible, floating D major resolution at the end. So you can hear, again, as with the Strauss, a sort of premonition of the later composer to come. But this work, even as Schoenberg identified it himself, is very firmly in the post-romantic, in the era of Mahler, the composers who came immediately after Wagner and Brahms. A name that Daniel mentioned earlier is Alexander Zemlinsky, who studied with Brahms. He was also a teacher of Schoenberg's. So there are some very strong literal connections between these musicians. And if you think that it wouldn't matter very much that your teacher's teacher was that far removed or that close in terms of their removal from you, these things are still quite important. I have a teacher in my past who is only 2 generations removed from Brahms, And what I learned from him, some of it still seems very connected to Brahms himself. So it is quite significant that Schoenberg had been studying with a pupil of Brahms at this time. And ultimately, Schoenberg and Zemlinsky were more closely tied as well through family marriage. So they knew one another quite well. So these connections are very strong. So you will hear some Brahms in this. I like to think of the opening of this piece as a dirge that Brahms could have wrote. Then it goes into the dirge that Schoenberg did write.
Mm-hmm. But let's thank Jason for being here. And
thank you.